The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus up to $1,500. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
All right, folks, we're back for hour number two, and Bob Crable has been kind enough to spend the time with me and John Panarese across the way from me as we profile his career as a not only a high school and college football linebacker, but now we are into his Jets career. And Bob, after that 82 season and the loss in the Mud Bowl to Miami, the Jets, wound up some things happened, and Walt Michaels was fired. And Joe Walton came in. The last year, 1983, was the last year at Shea Stadium. Strangely enough, my first game, because I grew up playing ice hockey, and I had hockey a lot of times on Sunday mornings, and my dad was not letting me miss it. Strangely enough, the first Jet game I ever got to go to in person was the last game ever played at Shea, and because it was on a Saturday, against your favorite team, the Steelers.
I remember it, absolutely.
And this, can you recall the last game at Shea and what it was like for you at all, if it meant anything?
Yeah, well, two things. Number one, I love Shea Stadium. My family, when they would come up, we would hear stories about the things that some of the people would do. They would bring in hi-fi systems. They bring in radio systems or play their own genre of music. They'd put the speakers up in the rafters at Shea, and they would just blast these things. And you'd have, a dozen or more different types of music all over the stadium because these people would be allowed to bring their own stuff in and set it up.
Right.
It was a very, very unique place. And I'll tell you what, it wasn't until that everyone decided, the management decided that we were going to the Meadowlands that some of my issues began with my knees. But that the game that we had with the Steelers, Terry Bradshaw's playing still, Benny Cunningham's playing. I'm thinking of Mike Webster. I'm thinking of some of these guys. These are guys that I looked at and said, holy crap, and I'm hitting them. I'm, Franco Harris is playing. I'm hitting Franco Harris. These are things that you just don't think are going to happen to you.
Right.
And it was, the unfortunate part was, we lost that game. What do I remember? I remember Benny Cunningham. I'm playing cover two, which means if the tight end goes vertical up the middle of the field, I'm going to have to take him man-to-man. Well, Benny Cunningham comes out, and he does a little button hook at about 10 yards, and I stop, okay, and I'm covering him. And the next thing I know, the ball comes over my head, and Benny Cunningham is taken off down the field. And needless to say, they scored a touchdown on that one. So, you learn things when you're young, and you just keep plugging away. And the Steelers certainly had the experience of some great veterans that were playing. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, that was Terry Bradshaw's last game.
Yeah, it might have been because that was the 83 season. It might have been.
Right.
Because Pittsburgh, let me see something here. I'm pretty sure that was his last game in 1983.
It was around that time because I remember I was in high school when he retired.
Yeah, but we had some, that year it was really kind of a roller coaster ride because the expectations were so high with Joe and what Joe had done with our offense. The year before, Walt was so much of a no-nonsense guy, where Joe was more of a talker. Walt would come into a meeting, he would, I have two thoughts
Right.
Basically expressed in about four sentences, and he'd say, okay, get to your meetings. Okay, Joe would have, you know, a 15 to 30 minute meeting before we break down into individual meetings, and some of the guys struggle with some of that.
You know, when they retired Joe Klecko's number, I heard him in an interview on the radio one time, and he said that that he just felt that after Walt Michaels, a lot of the practices seemed like they were high school practices. They were just way too long, like, you know, 3-hour practices. So maybe that.
Oh golly, we had 2-a-days.
Right.
Two 3-hour practices a day.
Wow.
And we got after it. And you know what? Quite honestly, if you go back and look at some of the injuries that resulted in that, you know, mine being two of them, you know, is that what you need? You came out of training camp. If you survived training camp, you came out and you felt like, you know, you had that you were sharp,
right?
You know, because we got so many looks, but. Surviving training camp sometimes was tough.
You think that was the biggest difference, one of the biggest differences between Walt Michaels as a head coach and Joe Walton was it was just maybe a little too much with Walton, just too much time spent on the football field?
I don't even know if it was too much time spent.
Right.
What I think it was, Walt had a very no-nonsense attitude. Walt,
right.
You know, I remember Walt coming in sitting down with me with my first one-on-one meeting with him.
Okay.
And he says, you know, let me tell you something, son. I don't give a shit what you do as long as you come to play on Sunday. You play on Sunday, okay, then, you know, if you screw up, he said the team might have issues with you.
Right.
He said all I'm worried about is what you do on Sunday. And you know what? That was the attitude that football team was raised on.
Right.
Up to that point. Joe came in. He says, "Oh no, 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 no! There is a lot more that goes into this than playing on Sunday."
Uh-huh.
And you know, hey, those are coaching philosophies that you have to adjust to if you're going to play for various people.
Right.
So, you know, if you look at who I like playing for better, I only played for Walt for 1 year.
Okay.
But, you know, Walt was. Yeah, I liked Walt.
I liked Walt. I just thought he was a better head coach. I mean, I was a young kid, but I just, history is a Jeff fan. I just liked his style. I liked the way the team was, you know,
right.
Under him.
You knew where you stood. You always knew where you stood with Walt.
Yeah. I did.
Because he would call you a rotten SOB just as easily as he would say, hey, nice job.
Right. I did like Joe Walton's offense because now you go to the Meadowlands.
Absolutely.
All right, so now you go to the Meadowlands in 1984. The team actually starts out 6-2. You know, there were some issues going on. I know Kenny O'Brien didn't get the start from day one. They had some issues at a little Studio 54 incident with Mark Gastineau early in that 84 season, or maybe it was before the season even started. Do you recall that incident? Do you remember hearing about that in the locker room?
I wasn't there, but, yeah, it was Joe Walton made a big deal about it, you know, just because – couple things. Number one, Mark is one of the premier players on the team.
Right.
And, you know, I think Joe's stance was, why do you want to put yourself in a situation like that where you're going to create issues for yourself and for the organization? And he had a point, but, you know, Mark was a tremendously talented and an incredible pass rushing football player, and you know, he did some outlandish things, just like we all did at that time in our
right.
lives. Unfortunately for him, he was in a position where he was going to get reported on more than I was.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I was not in the limelight like he was.
Right. You know what, Bob, different circumstances, but, you know, when you talked about being a Reds fan growing up and you loved Pete Rose, I could hear it in your voice. And Pete Rose is a tremendous ball player. But then when you hear about some of the things that went on post-playing career and stuff, you're almost like, as a fan, oh, I wish he didn't do that, right? And I was a big-time Gastineau fan. when I first started playing football. I loved Klecko, too. I remember in junior high, 1 year I wore Klecko's number, and the next year I wore Gastineau's number. And Gastineau was, I mean, early 80s, starting a year or so before you got there. I mean, the guy was first or second team All-Pro 5 years in a row. He's one of the top 10 pass rushers of all time, but yet he's never even been voted on for the Hall of Fame. And a lot of it has to do with stuff he did, you know, away from the field and maybe the way he was with teammates in the locker room, immature stuff. And as a diehard fan, I'm always like, I wish it wasn't the case because I really love the way the guy was, you know, he was so dynamic as a pass rusher. And that's just the way it goes with some of the athletes that you grow up being a fan of. That's just the way it is. But he was, like you said, tremendous, tremendous defensive end.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what I learned to do when Bud Carson came in eventually in '84, and they moved me because I actually blew my knee out the first time there in the spring in our mini camp.
Okay,
we just in a drill in a stupid drill, I wind up twisting my knee. I tore my ACL. And, they wind up – I tried to come back off of it, in the beginning of the season. I played a few games, played a couple good games, and wound up in a position where once we got over to the Meadowlands in 84, my knee wouldn't hold up on that turf.
Right.
So they had to do surgery on it.
So you got hurt before you even went to the Meadowlands is what you're saying.
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah, but it's on that nasty AstroTurf stuff.
Right.
So I've heard from reading a lot of stuff with people who played over the years, and I don't know if were you interviewed by Greg Prado for his book on the sack exchange? I don't remember.
I wasn't.
I don't remember if you were or not, but a lot of the guys talk about the AstroTurf and how much it took away from their careers.
Right. No, it was a. For me, it was certainly a detriment. Like I said, I do something stupid. I'm trying to be the champion. That once again, that competitiveness that I told you about that my brother got me when I was a kid.
Right.
I was in a position where I wanted to win this competition. What I thought was a competition, going through basically a four corner drill, and I planted. Opened up my foot didn't suck into the turf, and pop, my knee popped. It is what it is, but I didn't get to experience, 84 and 85 were really, I shouldn't say, let's see, 83, 84, I think Joe Gardy was still there.
Yeah, 85 was the first year with Bud Carson. 85, I know,
Bud
was the first
came
year.
Came in 85.
Uh-huh.
Dan Radakovich was actually the linebacker coach that year. And we learned so much. Dan Radakovich was involved in teaching so many fundamentals that by the time that season was over, that may have been the best, overall, linebacker psyche that team, that all of us as linebackers, because I think that was Kyle Clifton's first rookie year.
Okay.
So I think by the time that year was over, we were just in a mindset where that's as best as we've ever played.
Well,
and that's not saying it's the best that the team has done.
Right.
But as a group of linebackers, as a defense, we were as sharp as we could have ever been.
Well, I'll tell you, because in 1985, the Jets defense, the only two teams that ranked behind, and I'm talking about points allowed and yardage, were, obviously the Chicago Bears, the 85 defense,
and the
San Francisco Niners. I think they gave up one less point than the Jets. Jets had, a phenomenal team. To me, and not only because of Klecko and Gastineau and Lyons, and then the linebacking core with you and Lance Mell and Kyle Clifton came into the fold, and the defensive backs, but also on offense, you had Ken O'Brien at quarterback with Al Toon and Wesley Walker, and you had Free McNeil with Johnny Hector, and you had Mickey Schuler at tight end. It was probably the best all-around skills group I had seen as a Jet fan. And if you take
one of the people that sometimes the offense forgets about,
right?
You remember Rocky Kleber?
Yeah, he was Rocky, a backup tight end.
Rocky, exactly. But Rocky played, because of Rocky's versatility,
right.
He was able to play that H-back, the tight end that moved around.
Yep, in motion,
he
yep.
He was the second tight end. I mean, it created a lot of different looks for defenses with our offense, and it created some real issues for them.
That team was extremely exciting, and if you take that 85 season and the first part of 86 before all the injuries when the Jets started 10-1,
right.
That period of time the team was 21-6, you know,
yeah.
Until the end of that 86 season. Now, in 85, you finally lined up at linebacker, and the Jets beat
yeah.
the Dolphins while you were a member of the team on a Monday
sure.
night. I'll never forget it. And Bud Carson's defense, you felt it right away. I remember going to the home opener that year in 85 after the,
yeah.
the Jets had a couple of holdouts. I remember my dad talking about it with Marvin Powell, and there was another offensive lineman. You got blown out on opening day out in L.A. against the Raiders. And then when you came
yeah.
home, I went to opening day, and you beat the Bills like 42-3. I mean, it was great. I mean, the defense really started to dominate with that second game moving forward. The game I wanted to ask you about was a game against the Buccaneers. I was actually at the highest offensive output I've ever seen the Jets put up. They beat the Buccaneers 62-28. The funny part, Bob, was it was probably the only time me and my dad were late to a game because we went with relatives. You know, it always gets disrupted if it's not just me and my dad. And when we walked into the stadium. I mean, the Jets were flying high. I mean, top of the division, they're battling with Miami and New England. And we
yeah.
walk in and they're losing 14-0 in the first quarter. We're like, what, are you kidding me? And by the end of the day, you would have never known, when, you know, because you're a fan. You're like, oh, my God, 14-0. 62-28, they rolled it up that day offensively. Do you remember that game? Anything stick out in your mind?
Vaguely. Vaguely.
Really?
That was one. Yeah. Yeah, that was that was one that, you know, was kind of a blur. You know, they sometimes when things get rolling,
right?
You know, it just, golly, everything just happens. And you know what? And the games are a blast. You have fun. You know, you're talking about, you know, early on,
right?
You know, we give up a couple touchdowns, and things just start to click. You know, things are, you wonder, you know, and like I said, I don't remember exactly how it all came about, but, man, when they click, it just happens. And, you know, hey, those guys up front, they had a lot to do with, you know, with how things get rolling during a game.
Right.
And good and bad. You know, the front four was always where things started. And I'd love to be able to say that, you know, the linebackers were the catalyst. But those guys would keep people off. But I'll tell you, you know, when Joe Klecko was in a position where, you know, when Joe got moved inside because of his knee injury,
right.
He gets moved inside. And I'll tell you what, he would grab the face mask of an offensive lineman who was trying to get off to the next level and get a penalty called on him sometimes because his job was to keep the offensive lineman off the linebacker.
Right.
And he took that so serious that, you know, those are the things that, hey, this is my job.
Was Klecko the strongest guy you played with?
Yes. Yeah.
Kenny O'Brien was on with me last year, and he told a story about he was at a Pro Bowl, and Dwight Stevenson, a famous offensive lineman from Miami, the center.
Oh, I remember Dwight, sure.
Actually spoke to him, like, you know, because they were on the same, you know, the AFC
right.
Pro Bowl
right.
squad, and he talked to him about Joe Klecko, how Joe Klecko would literally, like, pick him up and throw him down to the ground after plays, and he just couldn't understand the extreme strength this guy came with. Was Klecko the strongest guy on that team?
Yeah, no doubt. But well, Joe was he had strength. You know, if your hands are so strong, he had great hand strength.
Right.
And when you can grab someone with such power that he had in his hands, and obviously his forearms, he was certainly you know, weight room strong, and could bench and lift as much as anyone on a football team.
Right.
But the power that he had was in his hands. I'll tell you who else is like that. Lance Mell's like that. They have both those guys had so much, their hands were so strong, and when they grab you, they could just, they can control you.
Like a vice grip, tremendous grip strength.
Amen,
yep.
That's right.
I got
that's
you.
Right. But both those guys, and Joe was so quick with his hands. Joe could go from the ground, you know, to someone's breastplate on their shoulder pads faster than, that's why Joe was so good.
Right.
You know, Joe was so good because the old adage of, inside hands win, where, you know, if you're a defensive lineman and you get your hands to the breastplate before an offensive lineman can get his hands to your breastplate, you're going to be able to control that guy.
Right.
And it's a fight on who can keep inside position like that. And it's always been like that. Now, you know, they let him grab the outside. They just maul you. You know, these offensive linemen today are just so big. You know, if they're not 330 pounds, I'm not sure they can play anymore.
Oh, yeah. All right, now, sir, go ahead.
But I was just going to say, there's different, Joe, I don't know if Joe could have survived in today's world. I don't know if I could have survived in today's league just because of, some of the rule changes that they've had.
Right.
But doing what we did back then, Joe was as good as anyone I knew. And Dwight Stevenson was one of those guys who was so quick when he snapped the ball that if he said Joe, could get his hands on him that fast, that shows you how fast Joe Klecko's hands were.
He told Ken O'Brien that Joe Klecko was one player he was actually a little fearful of.
Yeah.
So that's pretty impressive for a football player to say that, admit something like that, just because of his strength.
Dwight, I'm not sure how many times Dwight made the Pro Bowl, but he made him a few times. And he was my goodness, I played against Dwight Stevenson many a times, and I had my struggles with him, no doubt about it.
Yeah, he's as good as you saw. He was first team All-Pro at least four or five times. He's in the Hall of Fame. I mean, he had his career ended early because of injury, too,
yeah.
But he was just so dominant they put him in. They knew he was the protector of Dan Marino. So
yeah.
Now, since we mentioned Dwight Stevenson, in 86, the last big season for you with the Jets, because 87 didn't go the way we would have hoped, but in 86 the Jets start out 10-1, and that's the year where they beat Miami in that famous overtime game, 51-45. As a defender, how did you react at the end of that game when the Jets are losing at the end of regulation and they're down to the last play where they just tied it to go to overtime? Do you remember what it was like? Look, staring defeat right in the eye with the seconds ticking down.
Yeah, oh my goodness, it was like just take a deep breath.
Right.
We survived. Oh. And I'll tell you what, Bud Carson just about blew a gasket. He was so mad that we gave up that many points in that game. You know, no one could talk to him after the game. Someone, I don't know if it was Lance, it wasn't me because I wasn't gonna say anything to him after that.
Right.
Someone said something to him about, surviving and I can't even repeat what in the world he said because he was as angry as I've ever seen Bud Carson.
Hey, the guy was the architect of the Steel Curtain, and you guys gave up 45 points. And I know as a coach, and you coached, he doesn't care if it's Dan Marino slinging the ball around.
Amen.
He ain't giving up that many points defensively and being happy about it, which is, what
That's
an exciting
exactly
finish
right.
to the game. You know what? I'm sure in the end, he just got back to business, and you guys moved along. And like I said, top three defense in the league in 85, 86, you're starting out that way, 10-1. One of the games during that season, I don't know if you recall this game, I only remember because my dad couldn't stop talking and gushing over Bud Carson. And it was a Monday night game. I remember because I had football practice. I couldn't go with my dad. You guys were playing the Denver Broncos. And
I think
from what my dad was telling me, and I watched the game on TV, but he was saying that Bud Carson had Bobby Humphrey as like a secret weapon on defense. Do you remember this? That he had him like...
He was nickelback.
That he had him hawking?
He became the nickelback. And... You know, he was, you know, and I can't tell you who in the world he was spying on, but
he was spying on John Elway, actually, if I remember correctly.
We got some heat on Elway that year.
Right.
That was
he had five sacks in that game. Five sacks in that game.
We had some success. I actually had one at that game. So you know, it was a Bud was so competitive that you know, to score a touchdown against his defense was an insult to him. So you know, he was very prideful, no doubt about it.
I'll tell you what, you did have a sack that game, and so did your buddy Lance Mell. Five
Absolutely.
Sacks. I was so excited. Between that overtime win against Miami and then beating the Broncos, the way you guys controlled them on a Monday night, I mean,
right.
It was boom, 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 boom. And then all of a sudden the injury set, and Lance Mell's career came to an end on an injury. Gastineau got hurt, came back in the playoffs. A number of guys went down with injuries left and right. I mean, it was just too many. And but in the playoffs, I'll never forget, because, you know, VCRs just came out, or at least in my house, was the first time we had one. And the Jets had won their first home playoff game. Now, this is 1986. First home playoff game that you guys win since 1968, the year they won the Super Bowl. All right?
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, after halftime, Chiefs got the ball. Here comes a pass. And, you know, and Marv Albert's doing the broadcast on NBC. And all I could hear, and we rewound it like 1,000 times, me and my dad, said, MacArthur, Kevin MacArthur makes this interception return for a touchdown. I'll remember it more than anything in my life, probably, Bob, because, like I said, first time in VCR in the house, really, and we must have watched that play 1,000 times. We were so excited with that win.
Let me tell you, Kevin MacArthur was one. He was a phenomenal athlete.
Right.
If the game itself wasn't so complex,
right?
You know, he probably would have been a great outside linebacker had we just gone to a point. And I know they tried to rush the passer with him a little bit, but he could run. He was a great special teams guy, you know. But
hey, Bob, can you just stay with us through the break? Because we got a little background noise there. We're just going to go take a quick break, and I want to finish up talking with you about the end of that season.
Sure.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, folks. We got a little technical problem in the studio here. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we are back at Sports Talk 1240. Bob Crable, gracious enough to spend a ton of time with us, recalling those early to mid-'80s years with the Jets, and we're just about done here. But, Bob, like I said, that MacArthur pick for a touchdown at the beginning of that second half against the Chiefs, that playoff win was so exciting. The season itself, despite, you know, dropping the last handful of years, I was so excited, like I said, between 85 and 86. I personally, and I may be wrong because I'm just a fan, but I just thought with Bud Carson running the defense, the personnel on defense, the skill positions on offense, and I did like Joe Walton's offense. I almost looked at him more as being a better coordinator. I just thought, for me, and you know, I'm reading Sports Illustrated and I'm just observing the NFL. But in hindsight, looking at some of the coaches that came out of that era, like a Joe Gibbs or a Bill Parcells or a Bill Walsh, Don Shula, whoever, Tom Lynch, I just thought if the Jets had one of those marquee names coaching, if they would have followed up Walt Michaels with a big step in the direction of another coach along those lines and maybe a little more accomplished than even Walt Michaels, I thought that team really could have competed. Maybe not in 85 because, you know, the 85 Bears, you know, it's arguably the best defense I've ever seen. But I thought between those 2 years and going forward, I thought the Jets really had what it took to win a title, or at least were building in that regard. How did you feel, you know, being a part of those 2 years in particular, and because you didn't know your career was going to end after 87, but how did you feel coming out of those seasons and going into the next one?
Well, you know what, you're always and here's the crazy thing, Derek, is, you know, back in those days, you know, we didn't make enough money to be able to say, hey, I'm going to stay around there and we're going to work out and, you know, we're going to, you know, watch more film and we're going to do drills and all the things that they do now. You know, they used to tell us, hey, you know, go home, get a job, get yourself set up for when football's over because it's not going to last forever. And, you know, to be in a position where that's, you know, a season ends and you shift gears. You know, I had, at the time, in 1985, I started a sportswear company, and you know, we sold licensed product, mostly college licensed apparel, T-shirts, sweatshirts, that stuff.
Right.
And when the season ended, you know what? It was shift gears. I used to tell people when I came to New York, when I came from New York to Cincinnati, I'd hit the New Jersey Turnpike, and everything in my psyche switched. It was I became a New Yorker. It was get out of my way. I'll squish you like a bug. You know, I transformed my mind, I guess.
Right.
And when I got back to Cincinnati, you know, the same thing happened. I tried to have it happen. Didn't always work.
But, you know what, Bob? You started the sportswear company, and when I was growing up, no matter what, I was playing football, hockey, I played baseball, right. I wrestled, and I was always coming up with different things to, in terms of how I wanted to wear my clothing underneath my equipment for comfort and performance, right? And I never thought about it, but when Under Armour came out with all this type of different, you know, underwear and the shirts and everything, and I wore a lot of this stuff when I was a cop because it was had such a cooling effect. You know, during heat waves and under the bulletproof vest and all that. And I would sit there, I'm like, how could I not think of this? Like, some guy that went to Maryland University came up with this idea, you know, brought fabric to a guy. Hey, can you make a shirt out of this? Can you make underwear out of that? Can you make, and now they do it, like, they have contracts with college institutions. I think one of the ones they got a contract with was Notre Dame, and it's just everywhere. Now they do the sneakers. I mean, it pains me. God bless the guy who came up with the idea. I saw a documentary on him. He was, like, down to his last nickel. But
it's a multi-billion-dollar company.
I used to take things and cut this up for shorts and cut this up for shirts because I couldn't stand like undershirts sometimes. Just a great invention. The guy hit it at the right time, and now Under Armour. I mean, you could buy the stock. I guess it's probably like $100 a share, or whatever. But just one go ahead.
No, I was going to say when the season ended, you know, you're trying to balance now,
right?
You know, getting ready for the next year. You're not leaving a season. It's almost a, you know, almost like, okay, now what? You know, there's a void. And you're not going to see your buddies all the time. No. You're not going to be in a position where you're training with the people that you probably should be training with.
Yep.
And in a way, some of these guys today that train the way they do, I'm kind of envious, because if we were in a position where we would have trained that hard,
yeah,
obviously cycles are all different, but we could have done some great things.
Oh yeah, the way the union is today as opposed to even then, and the kid,
right.
These young athletes, they have their personal chef, they got their personal trainers, go to Arizona to train,
absolutely.
They're on vacation in the Bahamas, and they come in, yep. And they don't even run 2-a-days anymore. Man, now
absolutely.
with their new CBA agreement, they can't do anything. Like, they're hardly ever in pads for full contact practice. It's like, you got to be kidding me.
They can't go back-to-back padded practice.
Oh, my God. Don't get me started on that. Okay? All right, listen. I have to ask you about this because it just pertains to your years with the Jets. That last playoff game. You're up 20-10 against the Browns, right? We lose in double overtime. And the reason I was so excited by that 20-10 lead, because if you beat the Browns, you're going to play the Broncos again, who we spoke about when you blew them out on a Monday night. And that's why I just looked at that team, and despite the injuries and whatever else went on in the organization, the personnel that was there, I'm telling you right now, take away the Super Bowl Jets. I'm just talking post-NFL merger. That 85-86 team, it's probably on paper and performance-wise, if you look at the players and the guys that were all pro, whether it was the guys on the defensive line or even Altoon is still, to me, one of the best Jets I've ever seen, wide receiver or not. And Wesley Walker was all pro 1 year, and you had Kenny O'Brien. I just thought that the personnel on that team, that was probably the best Jet team I had seen play, regardless of the lack of playoff wins. And so,
I'll tell you what, you remember what happened in that game?
The one against the Browns?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that as soon as Fred McNeil ran like a 20-yard touchdown run to make it 20-10, on the radio, you know, you were playing the game, so you didn't hear this, but on the radio, the guy doing the Jet game was a guy by the name of Charlie Steiner. And as soon as Freeman scored, he said, "It's the Jets. Freeman scored. It's 20-10, and the Jets are going to the AFC title game." That's exactly what he said, if you could ever get a copy of it.
Four minutes to go. We've got a third. We've got a third and long.
Right.
And it may have been fourth and long. Okay, we got a third or fourth and long. And Bernie Kosar throws it down the field. Don't remember who he threw it to, but it was an incomplete pass.
Right.
And all I remember is seeing the flag.
Yeah,
apparently Mark Ruff Kosar.
Yeah, it was a third and long or a second and long. I think it was third and long, but yeah, it was it got them out of harm's way and gave them a first down. And
and you know what? And some people, you know, held that against Mark. You know, so
yeah, no, I know.
He
was probably trying to throw it to Webster Slaughter or Reggie Langhorne or somebody. But I remember, you know, when you guys went up 20-10, I thought, you know, this team's not losing this game. There's no way. I just saw that the whole game through. You controlled most of the game. And, you know, they didn't run much, but Kosar, you know, he threw the ball over 60 times. He threw for almost 500 yards. I mean, at that point, it was probably a record. But, it allowed them a chance. I mean, they still had to execute, but it allowed them a chance to continue that drive. They got a touchdown. They tied the game on a field goal and then double overtime. But, I'll never forget that game because I just thought that Jets get past this one. They get Denver again, you know, and if you can handle them the way you did the first time, you're going to play the Giants in the Super Bowl. I mean, the Giants went to the Super Bowl that year and won it, but that Jet team was something else. It was something else watching you play a linebacker with Lance Mell and Kyle Clifton and the whole defensive line and all the guys on offense. And I want to thank you for joining us tonight. You spent a ton of time with us.
Yeah,
I appreciate
definitely.
Every second. And I'm going to stay in touch with you. And we're going to get one night where we get you and Lance Mell on. Hopefully the Jets will keep
That's
playing
correct.
Well. And we get it in the second half of the season. If they're looking like they're going to playoffs or something like that, we'll get maybe you and Lance on together, and we'll have a nice little roundtable discussion. How about that?
That sounds great, Derek.
All right, Bob. Thank you very much for joining us.
You take care, Bob.
Thanks, Derek. John, you take care as well. Thank you.
All right, folks, there you go. Bob Crable spent an hour and 45 minutes. That's really the way interviews go on the Sports Talk 1240 when the Waz is hosting. They just, I like to listen. You give me, John, you give me a player from one of the teams I grew up rooting for, and I will profile the guy.
Yeah,
because you want to know what? Because growing up, sports meant so much to me, playing and being a fan, especially with the hockey, with the Rangers, and my whole family extended. And the football, maybe a little more so with me and my dad going to the games. And Bob Crable was a part of some of the best years I spent going to games at the Meadowlands, you know, especially those early years, 84, 85, 86. And
he just knew. I mean, he just remembered. It was great because he was just full of stories,
right.
And you know, kind of filling in you know, he was kind of taking what you were coming up with and really just filling in, you know, painting the colors, so to speak. So it was really, I enjoyed that interview. That was great.
You know, I didn't even have to ask him that many questions. I give him something and he just, you know.
And a lot of times I had questions, but he would answer them as he was talking.
Right.
You know, and as he was telling the stories, like something would pop in my mind. And then a little bit later, he would answer the question. I say, oh, I don't have to ask him that then.
Yeah, he answered. I didn't even have to ask him really about Walt Michaels or Joe Walton. Because I know that Joe Walton was probably the one thing that kept the Jets from really achieving more.
Right. And I was going to ask him about the two, the comparing it, and he kind of said it. You know, he sort of said it in not so many words. He told you who he liked better.
Yeah, he went into it with, Walt being a no-nonsense guy. And I know, I told him how I heard an interview with Joe Klecko one time. I just know that probably is the reason. I'm not trying to make an excuse for why my team didn't win. I'm just saying if those teams had a coach.
Right. No, I agree.
Some of the guys I named, I just think things would have went a lot differently. You know, like everybody, I understand the greatness of Dan Marino. He's a great all-time quarterback, never won a Super Bowl, but a great all-time quarterback and a Hall of Famer. And I'm not saying that Kenny O'Brien would have the stats that he would have, but I do know the teams they played on.
Right.
If Don Shula coached the Jets as opposed to coaching Miami, if you flipped Don Shula and Joe Walton, the Jets would have dominated Miami even more than they did, because after 1984, starting in 1985, when Kenny O'Brien really took over at quarterback, I mean, he was, I think, 8-6 against Marino head-to-head. Extremely good. And he had great skill guys to work with. The Jets had a good team. But, you know, they had that strike year in 87. They never really, you know, they started that year out 2-0, and then they never got going after that. Finished out of the playoffs in 87 and 88, they were 8-7-1, but that was, you know, another team, and there were some young guys coming in on defense, but they just never developed further
for
those mid-80s teams that I thought they just had everything they needed skill-wise on offense.
And that's why the Greg Prado book about the sack exchange, and I feel bad because I can't remember the name of it, and Greg was on, Gary and I interviewed him.
Okay.
And it's a wonderful book because it goes into a lot of detail, a lot of interviews with the key players. That's why I wasn't sure if Bob had gotten interviewed, and I know Greg Buttle was. And I know Gastineau and Klecko. I know he got a lot of good interviews. And it's a great book because it really goes into the detail of those 80s Jets teams and the stuff that was going on off the field. And, you know, you alluded to the Gastineau incident at the club, you know, and that's definitely highlighted in the book.
Right, from 1984, yeah.
Right.
I mean, I was young. I was probably in ninth grade. I heard about it. But the one thing I remember is it kept Kenny O'Brien from getting in there and taking over. You know, he was drafted in 83, so he didn't play really at all in 83. But 84, you would have hoped as a young quarterback he would have taken over at that point. I mean, Dan Marino was lighting the world on fire that year and took his team to the Super Bowl, although they lost to Montana and the Niners. But then in 85, strangely enough, like this is what I'm talking about, like in 84 I would have liked to see O'Brien take over that year. In 85, when he did take over, his first full year in the league, he led the league in quarterbacking. He was a Pro Bowler and everything. I mean, Kenny O'Brien had that's why I brought up that 62-28 win against the Buccaneers. The Jets' offense was flying high that year, and the defense was top three in the league.
And I just remember Al Toon, man. He was an unstoppable force, that guy.
You know, and I forgot to tell Bob I was wearing the 85. I have the 85 version of Al Toon's jersey on. Al Toon's my all-time favorite Jet. I thought he was the smartest player on that field, incredible possession receiver that could be a burner too. He on the deep route also, and he was great. He was 3 years. If that guy didn't suffer from concussions, because that's why he had to leave the league, because he had concussion issues. But up until his first bad concussion in 1989, he was drafted in 85, right? So 85, 86, the first 4 or 5 years, he was neck and neck statistically with Jerry Rice. Outside of the touchdown totals, he was neck and neck with him. Receiving yards, receptions.
Right. Receptions, right.
You know, and he didn't have Montana. He didn't have Bill Walsh, you know, drawing up his offense. But this is just the way, you know, team you're on and you perform. But Altoon was, he's one of the best jets I've ever seen line up easily. So we got about 10 minutes left. So I think we agree we should spend the 10 minutes on Major League Baseball and the playoffs coming
up? Yeah, might as well just.
All right, so the first thing that's going to happen is on Tuesday. Everybody knows, if you don't know the playoff scenario in terms of how many teams make the playoffs, too bad. We're not mapping it out for you. Okay, Tuesday night, the first wild card single elimination game. Houston's going to play at Yankee Stadium, and it's going to be Dallas Keuchel against Tanaka.
That should be good.
So you got each team's best pitcher, and I got to say, I'm going to give the edge to Houston coming into this game because I think Dallas is going to win the Cy Young Award this year. I thought he had an excellent season for Houston. Hinch did a great job managing. Nobody expected that team to
go
anywhere.
It's an amazing story. I mean,
you know, outside of Altuve, what does anybody really know, you know, about Houston coming into this season, right?
And they lost over 100 games, what, 2 seasons ago?
Yeah, they were a last place team.
Yeah, they were the laughing stock.
Last year they lost 92 games.
Right.
The 3 years before that, they lost well over 100 games.
Right.
So this year, 86 wins, or 87 wins. Well, they lost today. Didn't they lose today?
Yeah.
So they probably finished 86 and 76. But, I mean, this kid, I think Dallas Keuchel, he's got to win the Cy Young Award. 20 game winner this year. I know that David Price had a great season, and he got traded to Toronto and took off from there. But Toronto, you know, they slugged their way into the playoffs. I think Price helped solidify their pitching rotation. But this kid probably did more for any rotation in the American League than anybody. And 230-plus innings and the strikeouts over 200, I think you know, when you come to the playoffs and pitching and defense means so much, I think I got to give Houston the edge coming in to this one game play. How do you feel about this one?
Yeah, I just, the Yankees have, well, I guess neither team has been playing great down the stretch.
Right.
But I just think the Yankees, what got the Yankees to where they are, Teixeira is gone for the rest of the season. You know, A-Rod looks, it just seems like A-Rod's running out of steam.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know if the Yankees have really great pitching. You know, Tanaka's not been the knockout all the time. So I could conceivably see Houston, you know, definitely, you know, coming out with a one-game playoff. But I don't know. It's to me, I think Houston's going to win it, but it wouldn't surprise me if the Yankees did pull it out.
Right. Listen, the Yankees got some bats in their lineup. I mean, Carlos Beltran's been a little bit better down the stretch.
He's been, you know.
You know, McCann's been good for them this entire season.
He's had a career season.
For a catch. He's decent power production. A-Rod, you know, he could strike at any moment. I agree with you. He's been weak down the stretch. And although Teixeira's out, you know, I thought Bird did a great job filling in.
Yeah, he's kind of cooled off a little bit.
Right.
Well, most of the Yankees seem to have cooled off.
Yeah, there's nothing outstanding about their lineup. Nothing really fearful. Can they win? Hey, listen, they're going to be home. They're going to have a good chance to win the game.
That's the reason why it wouldn't surprise me if they pulled it out. If it was in Houston, I'd pretty much say Houston's going to win it.
Right. Well, you know what? It'll come down to, like, Brett Gardner's been weaker in the second half. You know, who's going to step up, right? Gardner, Chase Headley, it really depends on what's going to go on with some of these guys. I know Gregorius has been better in the second half at shortstop. He's picked it up at the plate. And like I said, Beltran's been better also. They lost Steven Drew. I don't really view that as a big loss.
No,
but
to
me, Teixeira is a huge loss. I think that Houston comes into this game loose. They got nothing to lose, like you said, all the 100 lost seasons. And the Yankees always have that pressure. Like, there's just a sense of entitlement with the fans, and expectations are always sky high. And I think, you know, rookie manager in Houston and probably a Cy Young Award winner on the mound. The bullpens, you know, I don't see a big difference. I think Miller had a great year for the Yankees, but you know, the closer for Houston, you know, had a decent year for himself also.
Yeah.
So I just don't see, you know, Gregerson probably has a little more experience in the closer role. I mean, this was Andrew Miller's first year as a closer. See, when postseason strikes, I tend to look at the closer position, and even like Toronto, like they have a young 20-year-old closer. he's going to have to prove himself. Osuna, I think, is his last name. So I give them the edge in the bullpen. They had very good pitching this year, Houston. You know, probably somewhat better than the Yankees. So I think because of that, and I just think they're going to have a looser attitude because they don't know what to expect. So I don't think they're really going to care about it. They're just going to go into the
game.
Right,
and have fun.
You know, and they're going to rely on their ace. And Tanaka, to me, you're always waiting to see when he's going to get hurt. And that's a big problem. That's always a problem lingering for the Yankees. But he's toughed it out, got through the season, put up decent numbers for himself, and he's going to start. And we're going to see what goes on, you know, come Tuesday. Now, on Wednesday, before we get to the Mets, on Wednesday, to me, John, that's the game I'm really intrigued with. And that's the Cubs at the Pirates. Because you got Jake Arrieta against Gerrit Cole. And, man, if you talked to me 2 months ago, I would have been like, the guy in L.A., not Kershaw, but Greinke. I would have said Greinke had the Cy Young locked up. But what I witnessed over the last month and a half, 2 months, from Jake Arrieta.
Yeah, he's pretty much taken over.
And the Cubs haven't made the playoffs since, what, 2003? I think he's got to win the Cy Young right there. I mean, and you know, I know they judge it on regular season only, but if he goes out there in Pittsburgh and he dominates that game, even if they lose like a low-scoring game, I think you got to give him the Cy Young.
Yeah.
The guy's been just that great. Career year, obviously, if you looked at the rest of his career, he never threw over 150 innings in a season, and this year he probably threw about 220, whatever it was. So what do you think about that?
I really give the edge to the Cubs. I know I have a couple of Pirate fan friends who are probably going to hate me for saying it.
Right.
But I just think the Cubs, for some reason, there's just something about the Cubs that I think is, I think they're a lot more of a dangerous team than people give them credit for.
No, I agree with you. And they're almost like opposite of where the Mets, their young stars are in the pitching department, you know, with DeGrom and Harvey and Syndergaard. You look at the Cubs with their lineup and what they bring. Now, Rizzo's been there a bunch of years, but Chris Bryant, this kid Addison Russell, Jorge Soler, they got a bunch of young guys that fill out their, you know, positions. I just think, you know, these guys have done a great job.
Yeah, and they played well. They've been playing well all season.
They got 9 guys, double digits home run totals.
Right.
You know, I mean, rookie Chris Bryant comes close to, I don't know what he had today, but before today he had 99 ribbies, you know, to go with his 26 home runs. And Rizzo is another guy, had 99 ribbies before today's game and 31 home runs. But you have balance in their lineup where anybody's capable of knocking one out. You know, I didn't even mention the kid Kyle Schwarber, right? There's another guy, another young guy. So they have a ton of youth in their lineup, and they got probably the best pitcher in the National League the last 2 months,
right,
without question, on the mound in Pittsburgh. Now, Pittsburgh's a little different story because Pittsburgh has a lot of experience. You know, they went to the playoffs last year, and that speaks, you know, it means something. They came back. They had a real solid season. And, you know, Gerrit Cole had a great year. Overall, their pitching staff did a good job. But, you know, you look at their lineup, and they hit all the way down. Starlin Marte, another good outfielder with a great stick, and Harrison, and they got Pedro Alvarez. So I think that might be, even though the other series are best of 5 and you got the Yankees and Houston, that might be the best game. That might be the best thing right there on Wednesday night. That one game playoff might be the most exciting thing you see in the first round. Now, we got 2 minutes left. The Mets are playing the Dodgers, all right? You're a big Met fan. I know it comes down to DeGrom, Harvey and Syndergaard versus Greinke and Kershaw. And I think, me personally, I think the difference is if the Mets have some semblance of the bats that they've had the last 2 months since they transformed after that trade deadline, I think they got a great chance to win that series. How do you feel coming
to it? I'm not so worried about home field advantage. I'm not so worried about what's happened over the last, you know, week or two. I the playoffs are a different story, and I think that the Mets have the hitting, and if they can light it up the way they've been lighting it up, I don't think it's going to matter that the first 2 games are in, you know, are in LA or not. I just have a good feeling about it. You know, I just think this team has really come from nowhere, and they got nothing to lose. You know, where the Dodgers are in a different situation, you know, as far as what the expectations are of the Dodgers. And I just think the Mets are coming here as sort of, you know, everybody still makes fun of them anyway.
Right. You know what? They're bringing 90 wins in a division title. Do we still have that caller on hold? Put him on real quick. We'll get him in for the minute. Who do we have? We have Ralph with us?
Yes, we do.
Ralph, what's going on? Are you a big Met fan like John here?
Die-hard Met fan. How you doing, John?
Hey, what's going on, Ralph?
How are you, pal?
All right.
Yes, I am a die-hard Met fan, and I have to agree. I was listening to your conversation a little while ago, and I have to say, I agree with John. I agree with the both of you guys with the Met situation. You know, the Mets got nothing to worry about, only because they're not pressured. They weren't even expected to win the division title.
Right. That's exactly it. It's a different situation.
Right. And you know something? The New York Mets have a young team. They're hitting. I think they just went sour the last week just because they had nothing. In their minds, they had nothing to play for.
Right.
You know, they shot their load from the other thing, and they felt like, you know what? We're just going to cruise.
Yeah, but you know what? You're right, Ralph. They transformed. They got the bats to do it. Because Cespedes is with those young pitchers, and that's going to carry the day, hopefully, for the Mets. I'll say they're going to take the series in 5. All right, folks, that's it for us tonight. We're out of here. We'll talk to you next time, Sports Talk 1240.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.